Welcome to the Men's Life Line Academy, where we help encourage men live the best life possible, get their dead heart beating, bring on stellar guests who woke up and now they're lying, ready to take on the world. Today, I got Ben Mitchell. Ben Mitchell is a physician assistant in heart surgery, and he's also a Christian public speaker and an author, so I can't wait to learn a little bit more about his writing and speaking gifts. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Zach, thank you. So good to be here.
So, you know, you're one of those guys that just popped up on X a little time ago and just been connecting, part of the growth group, and just love the heart mission that you're going out there trying to make a change in the lives of people better and improve their lives through your content. So the pleasure's all mine to have you here.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So why don't you tell us a little about yourself, Ben?
Yes. So like you said, I am a heart surgery PA, physician assistant. I've been doing it for about 5 years now. I primarily work doing open heart surgery with the team, but I've done a little bit of thoracic robotic surgery, which is, that's very fascinating as well. And there's certainly a huge need for it here, where we live kind of in the South. You know, there's a very big smoking population. I was blown away by how many people smoke when I moved to this area. So it's job security for those of us who work in anything lung cancer related. But anyway, I've been married for several years and have two little kiddos, and plugged into a local church and just love serving there. And I do some teaching there. And, but yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, I've been here in the South for about 5 years. I'm originally from Alaska, of all places. I love when people, you know, I'll talk with people, you know, locals, and like, huh, you're not from here. Where are you from?
And I know that twang, go have that the way you talk, and people can tell you in a quick second that you're not from here, huh?
Yes, yes. A lot of people will guess that I'm from Virginia or Pennsylvania or New York. So
you do have that kind of look, I'm not gonna lie.
So I always have fun with it. And it usually takes them, you know, I'll tell them farther north. And they'll get up to Maine and they've got no clue how, you know, like Canada. So like, well, it's kind of on the same latitude as Canada, but still US. So anyway, I have fun with that question. But yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Absolutely. That's a big transition to go from Alaska to the South. What caused you to make that big of a transition?
I did grad school, PA school in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I just had a fascination with traveling. I love to travel. I had a goal of 50 by 30. I wanted to see all 50 states by age 30. And I accomplished that about a month before I turned 30. So not too terribly long ago.
Going out there and already achieving many things, especially 50 states by 30.
Wow. Yes, it was a lot of fun. But I just wanted to kind of not just see all of these states, but kind of live in, you know, all the quadrants of the United States. I'm not sure if I'll actually do that. You know, I kind of had the Northwest checked off. And I guess Alaska doesn't really represent the Northwest contiguous states very well. But, you know, then I also had the Northeast checked off with being in Pennsylvania for a while.
Right.
But there was I had a family friend who was in this area, and I reached out to him, and it led to this job connection, and here I am.
That's awesome. So what got you involved in wanting to work with the heart, especially as a PA?
I enjoyed that part of the curriculum the most when I was in PA school. There's just something about the dynamic nature of that organ, the heart, that was just very fascinating. And I did well in the cardiac section. The funny thing is I did my real only experience with cardiothoracic surgery specifically before taking this job was a half day clinical experience I had with the cardiothoracic surgery team. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But the PA who I was shadowing said, Ben, don't ever go into CT surgery. Don't do it. you'll have no work-life balance. It's all work. So, but here I am working in CT surgery, and I've, you know, have found a way to strike up a work-life balance, and I really love it.
Now, how did you do that? Like, what was the catalyst for developing a work-life balance? Especially, I'm sure you're on call a lot of the time, especially working with the heart.
Mm-hmm.
So do you work more in like the child or adult unit or kind of both?
Entirely adult. Yes, okay. there's actually a significant difference between adult cardiac surgery and pediatric cardiac surgery. With peds, you're dealing more with congenital stuff, you know, like valve abnormalities, things like that. Whereas with adult cardiac, there's a lot more, you know, a lot of bypass surgery, a whole lot of bypass surgery. And, you know, we'll do valves as well, but kind of our bread and butter is bypass surgery.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, that's, I know some person who went through that, and it was a major surgery that they went through. And I have a little bit of idea about the on-call because my mom is actually a cardiovascular technician.
Really? Does she work in an OR?
Not an OR. Well, that's a good question. I have to figure that out.
Okay.
I don't think she works in, I mean, I'm not sure. I just know she worked with both the children and adult unit. And when she was on the adult unit, she got called in a lot more than when, I want to say, on the kids unit, I want to say.
Yeah. Well, that's
so really I just cool. know that she prepares things for the doctors and she's on call. That's pretty much.
Very cool.
So, yeah. So what's it like working and like getting your hands like deep in? Because I know before the COP podcast, as we have been talking for a while, like how much it like helps stitch up and really be inside the heart. So what's it like to actually like be involved in all that?
Mm-hmm. It's really fascinating. You know, one of the things that we do on a routine basis is stop the heart. So we can work on it without it beating, right? And I just remember the very first time I saw that, where all the lines on the screen go flat. And I remember thinking, and of course, everybody's cool, calm, and collected because that's the goal, right? In the cardiac OR, you want to stop the heart. Anywhere else in the hospital, I mean, people would be flying around, grabbing their crash cart, you know, pushing epi, you know, doing chest compressions. So it's just a very unique experience to see that on the monitors and to be a part of that every single day.
That sounds incredible that they actually stop the heart to be able to work on it. I mean, how do you keep the person alive? Because typically when the heart stops, everyone, like you said, kind of panics because time is literally of the essence. I mean, when someone's, either they collapse or something happens to them, like, you're like, how long were they out for? You hear like 5 to 7 minutes, you're like panicking because that's a lot of time.
Yes. Yes. So we use a bypass machine.
Uh-huh.
And it's the size of kind of the size of a small car. You know, it's a pretty big machine. There's someone running the pump. But that's how we keep the patients alive, the rest of the body perfused, the blood oxygenated. We run it through this fancy circuit to do all the things that the heart and lungs would normally do. So it gives us plenty of time to do the surgery while keeping the patient safe. So it's, you know, heart surgery it takes a big team. You know, it's not just a surgeon. It's not just a surgeon, the PA, you know, there's a big team at the table. There's a big team for anesthesia, big team running, you know, running the room. You know, there's a person on the heart lung machine, you know, that pump. It is a full team experience.
So how many people typically for like one patient?
In the operating room, I would say about half a dozen.
Okay. So.
And then you've got, you know, all the post-op care in the ICU and then the other care up on the floor and then follow-ups after the fact once they're discharged.
Right.
So it takes a team, takes a village.
Yeah, especially to keep someone alive, especially if they have to go through a quadruple bypass type of surgery to restructure the blood flow and everything. I mean, people who have thought of this and figured out the whole human body has been incredible. And as you were mentioning with how shocked you were when everyone was smoking, kind of reminded me of the thread that you made the other day when you're talking about the four worst habits: smoking, sitting, eating bad foods.
Yes. Yeah. If you want to stay off the operating room table, if you don't want to meet me in the operating room, you know, one of the best things you can do is stop smoking. Then of course you've got, and the other thing, a lot of people think about diet. Diet does have a big impact, but probably the bigger impact is actually a sedentary lifestyle that has huge, clear signals in the literature.
I know for the last last 10 years, they've been saying sitting is, you know, the new smoking. So I know people would tell me that, and it's just like, but haven't we been talking about this for at least a decade at this time? Because it's nothing new.
Yes.
And so how do you bring that kind of information to people where we kind of know the information? It's kind of like smoking, right? We know smoking is bad for you. We know it releases thousands upon thousands of chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Yet people still decide to pick up the cigarette, or now vaping has been huge and very popular for the last several years, mm-hmm. and of that nature. So it's like, how do you, maybe as a PA, as you're building your godly manhood on X, how do you really focus on not just bringing the information that we've known, but maybe having a different level of presentation about it? So I think it's like how we present the information is key, not, and because we know if we eat burgers and fries, we're going to have heart issues.
Yes.
I think people have known, it's like pizza. People love pizza, but pizza is literally the worst thing for you because it's all a carb. Like it's something but an unhealthy carb, but it tastes good.
Yes. Yes. That's a really good question. It's something that I've thought a lot about. And I think there's kind of this common theme across a lot of things that we do. But the way I approach it is it's really all about the implementation. Mm-hmm. I like to say knowledge is like paint. It's worthless until it's applied.
And that is your quote. That you got to make that your quote. And I know you love inspirational quotes, so you got to make
I love inspirational quotes. Yes, but it's all about the implementation. And a lot of people approach implementation from a willpower perspective,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's something to be said for discipline, right? You got to have discipline, but how do you fuel the discipline? How do you get that power to implement? And I like to think of it in terms of not willpower, but why power.
Okay.
And if you can have a strong enough why, you can power anything that you want to implement. And so when I have these conversations with patients, you know, we'll talk about smoking. And so I think there are a couple of different approaches when you talk about smoking or stopping or starting anything. And, you know, I think what I see a lot of at the hospital is it's approached from a billing perspective, right? And so if you're writing your note and you've got different problems that you're addressing, you know, you just have to write what you did for that problem and you can bill for it, right? And so I'll see other teams that kind of just check the box, you know, smoking cessation discussed with patients, strongly advised, blah, 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 whatever.
Okay. Okay. Now I see what you're talking about now. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so you write down the problem, smoking, in your progress note when you see the patient, and then you type out what you did to document it, you know, smoking cessation advised, discussed with patient. But I really genuinely want to see these patients stop smoking, mm-hmm. and lead a healthier life and achieve greater, not just greater lifespan, but greater health span. And those are things that I don't think a lot of patients really even think about, especially the health span. So anyway, I'll have a conversation with them about implementation. You know, what's your why power? You know, do you have a grandson or granddaughter that you want to see graduate high school or graduate college? You know, mm-hmm. what's your why? And then I'll talk about, you know, the other things to help with that implementation, like accountability and community. You know, I'll say, hey, who do you have that you know who can call you up every day and just check in on you and say, how are things going? You know, and I've run into a couple of people who don't have that at all. I've got no friends. I'm living by myself. That is so sad to me to see that. And that's not the norm, thankfully, but you know, usually there's somebody who they name who they can hold them accountable. And,
but I think it's realistic though, knowing that a lot of people feel more lonely these days than prior. Well, not as many people have friends, and that's why people are searching online for different groups and friends, because everyone seems more secluded these days. And a couple of questions. One, how much time do you have with the patients really talk about? Because I know a lot of doctors are, I know you're a PA, so it might be a little bit different, rushed, and they might do more of the scare tactic, like, you know you're going to die, right? You know smoking kills.
Yes. Yeah, and they already know that, right? That's the thing. They already know that what they're doing is going to kill them, but I've never smoked myself, but I've talked with people who, I mean, tons of people who have and who have stopped. And they say it is literally the hardest thing they've ever done in their life. Like it is so it's really addictive. And so, but yeah, so telling them something that they already know, it's not going to help. So it really does take a little extra time to help them develop a plan.
Right. Do you do that with them? Do you help them develop a plan, like maybe like a treatment plan of how to get them to stop smoking? Because smoking is one of the hardest things to really stop, because people use it to decrease stress and worry and nervousness, because it has that, cigarettes is funny because it has that effect where it helps temporary relief, like it helps relax the muscles and the stress in the body, but it has a quick half-life. I mean, its half-life is like nothing. And that's why I see a lot of people like, well, chain smoke, because the half-life's basically done. They feel relaxed and calm because it calms that muscle. And then it's like, well, now I need to have another one and then another one. And then it's like, oh, right. Finally, I can relax after 5-10 cigarettes. And people might go through a pack or two a day. And I know one way sometimes talking about it from a financial standpoint, because one pack of cigarettes, which is 20 cigarettes, can cost like 10, 12 bucks.
It's a lot.
It's not cheap.
Yeah. And if you add up smoking, so 10 bucks a day times 365 days, looking at over $3,000, right?
Right.
If you do that for, you know, 50 years, you know, you're looking at the cost of a starter home in some areas, maybe not so much anymore in 2024, but you could buy a lot for 150 grand, right?
You could have a down payment. Easily.
You got your down payments, yes, on your house in LA or wherever it is. That's another thing that I'll discuss with patients. But it certainly is a challenge between the efficiency that we need to, that we're kind of expected to have when we see patients versus giving patients what they need. You know, you're always kind of walking a tightrope of satisfying the hospital's desire for you to be efficient, but also really helping your patients. It's a tightrope walk.
Yeah. And then my second question is, did you read The Power of Discipline by Daniel Walter?
I haven't read that one. No.
So I was curious if you have, because you mentioned willpower and how a lot of people go through willpower trying to just physically overcome something. I just got to be mentally strong enough, physically strong enough to overcome this, and I'll overcome it. What Daniel Walter talks about is a willpower fatigue. So imagine like a battery, and when you go against something difficult and challenging, let's say smoking, since we're on the topic, it might be like this much already, right? You're already drained by that much battery, about half, let's say. And then the second one now is even more so, because the more you try to fight against something, the more power and energy you're actually using. So that's why he goes back to having that why, because with willpower fatigue, you can only last so long before you give in. And that could be with food addictions, that could be with smoking, that could be with sedentary life, lack of, you know, working out, because going for a gym consecutively might continue to bring that drain with you. You can only do it for so much, and then you go back to that habit because the neuron connections, the habit hasn't been confirmed, hasn't been developed completely yet.
Yes. Yeah. And that's sometimes, you know, trying to quit something after cardiac surgery is the worst time because after cardiac surgery, it feels like you've been hit by a Mack truck. Like it just absolutely drains you in every way imaginable. But I mean, that makes me think of just, you know, everyday life. You know, we have all these expectations put upon us. We're supposed to be doing X, Y, and Z. You're supposed to not be doing A, B, and C. And most people, you know, we live fairly busy lifestyles. And so It doesn't take much. It doesn't take much on a day-to-day. You know, if you're just trying to do one or two things new or stop one or two things, it doesn't take much to drain that willpower.
Right. And that's why you always have to find times to rest and recover, which people have a hard time doing because they tend to feel like they have to do something, right? They can't just sit and relax and replenish their energy. Like they get anxious just being able to sit like still.
Yes. And that's why I'm such a huge fan of Atomic Habits by James. Have you read Atomic Habits? James Clear. You read James Clear?
I have.
I love that book. But yeah, just the
idea to call out.
Yeah, just the idea of building systems. Yeah. And if you can turn just one thing into a habit, it takes that willpower kind of out of the equation because it's just a part of you. And so then you have this one habit locked in, you know, you're doing this one healthy thing or avoiding this one unhealthy thing. And then you can then go into habit stacking and build this whole system that does not, you know, once you've kind of built it, it no longer really drains that willpower battery.
Yeah, because he talks about how he was in the kitchen and he would try to do his book or he was writing something, whether it be an article, and kept getting distracted because it's good in the kitchen. So he had to move. And that simple system from moving from the kitchen to like clearing out his office, because I'm sure it was a mess or something like that. I think that's how the book describes. It's been a while since I read that section of it. And then all of a sudden he was more productive and spent more time writing because he had a cleaner space. And when we're talking about developing systems, I love that you hit on that because a lot of people, that's what they lack. They may not lack, again, they have the paint, but the question is how do they apply the paint? So that's just looking at a few minor adjustments that they can make. Like you may not be able to go walking for a half hour. How about a 5-minute walk?
Yes.
And you hear about that a lot about people who go to the gym for the first time. Just go for 5 minutes, leave. Next time, go for 6 minutes and then build that confidence because it can be very difficult, especially if you can find the gym very intimidating.
Yes, yes. Or even just walk into the gym and leave, right? He talks about distilling whatever behavior you want to start down to 2 minutes. What's the 2-minute trigger, right? And if you start doing that 2-minute trigger, then it starts becoming easy, really easy to follow through with the rest of it.
Yeah. So is that kind of how, so I know you're not, are you, so I know you're doing a growth group. And so what is kind of your purpose then, your why of being on X and building the godly manhood?
Yes. Yes. So I think it really, well, there are a couple things there. So it really hit home to me when I had my first son. It's like, wow, this kind of dagger to the heart, like, wow, like what am I doing? And just also just looking around to the world that he was going to inherit. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's so much going on in this world right now. I mean, there's still great people. There's still so much goodness in this world, but there's also a lot of decay and a lot of disorder and just, And it makes me sad just to see how things are changing in that way. So I want my son to inherit as good of a role as possible and to be equipped to handle whatever he's going to face. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of my biggest whys right there. I think a lot of the societal decay that we see, not all of it, but a lot of it, I think can be pinned on men not being men, not loving well, not leading well. I really believe, you know, where a man goes, where the father goes, so goes the marriage, and where the marriage mm-hmm. goes, so goes the family, where the family goes, so goes the society.
So what would, like, let's say, what would some characteristics of a man be to you?
He's got to love well. And okay. A lot of people, so
what does that look like, loving well?
Yes, a lot of people think of love as being the soft, fluffy thing, but as a man of faith, I think of Jesus as being the man who loved the best, who loved in a perfect way. And there certainly were times when he was very gentle, very tender, and that's part of it. But then you also look at the sacrifice, right? That's really where love gets its depth. And I mean, if you just read historically what actually happened in those Roman crucifixions, that is sacrifice. And he did that out of love. And so if men can return to that definition of love and living out that love in its fullest depth, all the way to sacrifice. I just think about Ephesians 5, where it talks about husbands loving their wives, mm-hmm. even as Christ loved the church. Whew, that is a tall order to love to the point of death, to love to that depth of sacrifice. So I think that's really the foundation of strong, godly manhood.
Awesome. So how are you working to build that up? So I know you're on Acts promoting a lot of scriptures and really trying to promote good qualities like love and being there for your families, being present and, you know, taking action, not just being on the sidelines, but in the field. And I see you posting about that and really trying to encourage people to grow. I know together you and I are reading the 15 Valuable Laws of Growth by John Maxwell right now.
Yes. Yeah. So first of all, it starts with myself. You know, it is the hardest person to lead, period, is myself. And so, just taking the time to making the time to spend time with what I believe is the source of true motivation and source of true goodness, God. You know, spending time with him, spending time in his word, spending time in prayer, doing my best to lead a prayerful lifestyle throughout the day. I mean, that's something I think is so underappreciated is just being in a state of mind throughout the day where my mind just drifts back to God and the things of God and into his wisdom and to how he would, you know, have me make this little decision. You know, how do I talk with this patient? How do I interact with this coworker? How do I interact with my wife right now? How do I interact with my son right now? Just kind of that prayerful mindset. So the first person, the hardest person to lead is yourself. And so just really doing my absolute best to live by example. But then also seeking to help other men with that. Especially other young men. And we've, you know, I try to post a lot about this on X, and we have this growth mastermind, the 15 Valuable Laws of Growth. I love having you on, Zach. I mean, just your comments and your contribution is just so valuable. And then we also have a guys fellowship group that meets in our home. In fact, it's happening tonight. Every 2 or 3 weeks, I'll host this. And, you know, rule number one is have good food. So, you know, we're throwing together a big meal tonight and then just have a time of just spending a little time in God's word and just, you know, thinking about these eternal truths that are so transformative and trying to hold each other accountable and rally each other on and encourage each other and you know, sometimes we'll have little challenges. This one time I had what I call the BGM challenge, the Billy Godly Manhood challenge, where every day they had to post on a little group that I had, that they did a little workout, and they spent, you know, they read a couple chapters in God's word. And what was the third one? There's a third one too, but just kind of this little challenge that really helped guys implement, and the group helped each other hold each other accountable. And it was just a lot of fun. A lot of good things came out of that.
That's awesome. You know, being a leader and really helping others. And one of the most important things you recognize, especially as you're a leader, is it really starts with you first. So to be able to lead others, it starts with you and learning how to lead and really how to have your own life in order as much as possible, of course, because we're not perfect. No one's going to be perfect. But as close to improvement, progression as possible. And so I know you recognize that. So how do you maintain that stamina? That it starts with you, where you have to be so intentional, because the mind can be a little bit lazy. The mind can be a little bit into that comfort zone where it really doesn't want to improve because it's scared. So what systems do you have in place to really help keep you aligned?
Yes. And believe me, it is it is easy to fall into that lazy trap. And it's, for example, I never used to be a morning person.
Okay.
When I was a teenager, like if I was up before 9 a.m., that was a big deal, right? And I never thought I would enjoy the morning hour. But this past week, I've been getting up at 5:20. You know, that's a huge swing from where I used to be. But I have my why, and there are things that I do to make it easier. Mm-hmm. For example, I will time block my morning. I have a piece of paper sitting on my bedside stand right now, and I have everything that I want to accomplish before I leave for work written on that paper, time blocked. And so I basically just have to hop out of bed and jump on the conveyor belt. And if I just stay consistent with that, those 10 and 15 minute time blockings for the morning, you know, I will get a little workout in. I will spend some time in God's word. I'll, you know, get some praying in. I'll be ready to go on time. The other thing I do is I make it easy to do those things. So I will have my workout clothes and my Bible on the floor beside my bed. So I will literally trip over them, you know, as I'm getting out of bed. And it works. It works.
And if you need a doctor, you know who to call.
That's right.
That's just right. Go to work that day. Like, hey, listen, I just busted my leg. Just, you know, tripped over the gym clothes and the Bible. And, you know, just was so excited. I guess, can you help me out? Can you, you know, kind of just do a little quick nudge and fix it?
Just a little traumatic brain injury. That's all. Just a little
subarachnoid. Just a little. Oh, man. So what made you decide to become a morning person, especially if you're like a night owl, you like staying up late, waking up past 9? What was the catalyst for that? I'm going to start getting up at 5:20 every single day.
Just the momentum. The momentum that I had from starting early was tremendous. You know, when I would not wake up early, I would look at the clock, it would be noon before I was just really getting my day started. It's like, I mean, people have put in almost a full day's work by noon in some situations.
Right.
I just didn't have that edge, that focus, that momentum. And that you kind of have to force yourself to have when you're getting up at 5. Because if you're getting up that early, you're going to have a reason. You're not getting up at 5:20 for no reason. So just right. That alone, you know, starts you off on a good foot. So I love inspirational quotes, right? So another one goes something like, to go to bed with satisfaction, you must wake up with determination.
Ooh.
And so that's, I get that sense of determination when I'm getting up at 5:20 or 5:40, whatever early hour it is.
No, I think that's amazing, because you know, I can kind of relate to you a little bit because I've become more of a morning person as I've gotten older. And there's definitely, when you would wake up later, whether it be 10, 11, it just feels like the day was kind of wasted. Like the day just went by. And I always try to make every day like intentional and living. And the more I noticed the earlier I would wake up, the more I had my full day, I felt like there's more things to do, accomplish, get done, whether clean a little bit or organize something. And always had a little bit more alertness and more feeling fulfilled, if you will.
Yes. 100%. I'm with you on that. 100%.
So hopefully this can encourage other people. Get up an hour early. Get up a half hour, 15 minutes. See how it can improve your life. That's a challenge for you right now.
Yes. The other thing I've discovered is your morning starts the night before. And so even just... Go ahead.
I was going to say, go ahead, finish. I was like agreeing with you, like getting excited. Like, yeah. Yeah.
So that's, if you can start the night before with that sense of determination, like it takes discipline to get to bed at 10 or 9:45 instead of 11 or 11:30, right? It literally takes this, it takes intentionality. And if you can start the evening before with that intentionality, it just naturally spills over to the next morning. And you can actually wake up that extra hour without sacrificing, you know, quality sleep. Because I'm also a firm believer of getting quality sleep and adequate sleep. I mean, yes. It used to be back in the day, you know, the macho men were like, sleep is over. You don't need sleep. You know, sleep is for the weak. But
right.
I mean, you can't deny literature is. If you're going to operate at your best, operate at your peak, you got to power it with sleep. And so I'm not a fan of going to bed late and still waking up early. I mean, sometimes you got to, but start the night before with discipline to get to bed an hour earlier so you can wake up the hour earlier.
And a lot of the people who do maybe go a few days with like 2-3 hours of sleep, they only do it for a short stint. They don't do it for a long time. Just, you know, that's where a lot of the, and it takes a different type of personality and energy level to be able to do that too, where kind of the person that comes to my mind is Mark Cuban, who discusses when he was coding, he would spend a few hours, you know, get only a few hours of sleep because he was coding all night and day. Elon Musk talks about that when he was in the early stages with PayPal and how he would stay up really, you know, he would basically work during the day and then he would code at night where that was the only time he had it. But those kind of men are driven just a little bit differently than like a typical person. That's why they're billionaires. They just have a different type of drive and energy level, really.
Yes. Yes. And I know a couple people who are that way as well, personally. And it's, you know, they can sleep consistently 4 hours a night for like 2 weeks. And then on that 14th, 15th night, they crash for 12 hours.
Correct.
You know, and they can just do that indefinitely. Like, you know, I kind of wish I could do that myself. I'm not wired that way. I kind of wish I was, but you just have to work with what you got.
But that's important to recognize that it's just not you, and that's okay. You don't have to be, you know, the person who, you know, works, gets up 4 hours. What matters is being consistent and driven. That's what matters is if you want to improve your life, to be consistent, have your why, and then when you go to bed, be very mindful and aware of how you go to bed. Because I found, and I've talked to other people this to confirm this, so it'd be really cool to hear your perspective, is how we go to bed is how we wake up. If you go to bed dreading the next day, you're going to wake up, I don't want to wake up. I don't want to be here. Like, I don't want to get up. This is a nice, cozy bed. I just want to stay here. But if you go to bed, hey, today was a tough day. It didn't go exactly as planned. However, tomorrow's a new day. Tomorrow's a new opportunity to make things a little bit better and take care of myself just a little bit more. So I'm going to be grateful to myself when I wake up. I'm going to appreciate myself by moving. So it becomes that affirmation and you're validating yourself and recognizing it's still hard. However, you still have an opportunity to still get better.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, 100%. I feel like if I go to bed absolutely exhausted, you know, an hour or two late, that is how I wake up. You know, but if I can discipline myself, even if I have a little, you know, a little harder time falling asleep because it's 9:45 as opposed to 11, you know, I'm just more likely to bounce out of bed the next morning, you know.
Well, and that's also recognizing how much sleep you need too, because some people need 4 hours sleep and they can function really well. Some people need 7 or 8, 9 hours of sleep to be able to function, and that's okay. You just have to recognize what's the level amount, the, you know, the quantity of sleep that you need to be able to function at your best.
Yeah. And it takes some level of self-awareness, you know. In fact, this past week, you got to know yourself to grow yourself, right? The law of awareness, you know, from mastermind. I mean, you do have to have some level of self-awareness and kind of explore yourself a little bit, your needs, your strengths, your weaknesses, to really operate at your peak and to continue to grow yourself.
No, you're 100% correct. And then my other question, maybe another book, is Miracle Morning by Hal Elrod. I don't know if you heard of him.
Yes. I think I may have the book somewhere. He also has a documentary on YouTube.
Yep, he does. I haven't watched it yet. I've been wanting to watch it. I haven't watched that one yet.
Yes, I have not read the book, and I think I started the documentary, didn't get too far, but I've heard him speak, you know, on other YouTube videos and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, he has just like an incredible story. And again, just like the rest of us, he was not a morning person, yes. Which gives you hope that you can become a morning person. And that just means getting up a half hour to an hour from what you typically do. Mm-hmm. And that's how I define, like, if you're a morning person, for you, if you get up at 9, 8 o'clock is the morning.
Yes.
If you get up at 11, hey, 10 o'clock, technically that's still a morning. If you get up at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, definitely if you're up by 10, you're definitely the morning still versus the afternoon. So even from a logical standpoint, this makes sense. So, you know, focus on getting up maybe like a half hour to an hour earlier than what you typically do and see how much more time you have for a day. Take a risk, see what happens. And then as we kind of wrap things up, and I just want to, again, thank you for your time, your knowledge, and all the inspirational quotes, and definitely quote the pain one. You got to make that one your own. What would you like to leave off with someone today? In about a minute, what would you like to speak life into someone today? What would you like to say to them?
Well, I think I'm going to go back to my why, because that's what I'm really passionate about. And I do see that we're in some ways in a culture crisis. And I do feel like I'm on some level that has to do with the failure of manhood. Mm-hmm. I would just say, step up and be the man God designed you to be. Learn to love well, learn to lead well. And just be that man and give. Just give back in every way that you can. Just sow seeds. Just be someone who's known for sowing seeds, giving, just and don't do it to expect a return. But if you do that, you're gonna get a return and it's gonna be amazing. And even if it's just seeing the amount of goodness that you have allowed to kind of propagate and grow just because of what you've done, that in itself would be an incredible reward. So live well, lead well, be the man God designed you to be.
Well, you heard from Ben. Live well, be well, and rise up today to be the man that you're called to be. Take today to take that opportunity, do the very best you can in life, be that man of action, and you gotta go follow Ben. Ben's a great guy. He's gonna give you that health information, that knowledge, that system on X and any other platforms he's on. And reach out to him. He has a growth group. Might want to grow yourself and check that out. And we always like to put our guests first as thanking them for their time. So go follow him, support him. And if you're a man looking for some help, we got the Men's Lifeline Academy. It is a subscription-based program and where we help you develop the manhood in you. So this has been the Men's Lifeline Academy, and thank you for joining.